Matthew chapter 2, verses 16 through 18. Rachel weeping. The fifth talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on April 12, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
Okay, good afternoon. It's nice to see you all. We have been looking at the birth narratives in Matthew. In particular, we've been looking at four references that Matthew makes to Old Testament passages. Each time Matthew says that something in the Old Testament is fulfilled in the life of Jesus, we find ourselves asking the question, what is he talking about? Because each of the examples is somewhat problematic. Each one represents a different challenge in trying to see what he's doing. So far, we've talked about two of these passages. The first one was about the virgin will conceive and bear a son and call his name Emmanuel. And the second was, out of Egypt I called my son. Today we're going to look at the third of the four fulfillment passages in this section. We will start reading at Matthew chapter 2, verse 16. Remember that the Magi had come looking for the Christ child. Herod asked them to come back and tell him where the child was, but the Magi tricked Herod and left by another way. So now Herod has no way of knowing where the child is. So in 16, we read, then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its vicinity, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the Magi. Then what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. So our task today is to figure out what Matthew is doing with this Old Testament quotation about Rachel weeping. Let me tell you how I think about what we're about to do. We're going to be talking about some history. We're going to talk about a person named Rachel. We're going to talk about the circumstances under which the prophet Jeremiah is writing. We will remind ourselves of the history of the Jewish people. But we are not doing this merely because we are students of history. History is great. It's great to study history. But we're not gathered together here today so that we could watch a PBS special on ancient Israel. We're interested in what is often called salvation history. The history of Israel is the history of God's working to save the world. The fact that a woman named Rachel had children is in fact a part of this story and hugely important to the entire world if we actually understand what's at stake. It's hugely important to you and me. So that's why we're going to look into these historical matters, and Matthew has sort of forced our hand because he's making us look into these historical matters. He is quoting from a passage in Jeremiah, but we're not going to turn there first. First, we need some background about who Rachel is. We start with Abraham. You remember Abraham. Remember that Abraham had great promises made to him. He was going to found a great nation, and all the nations of the earth would ultimately be blessed through him, through them. Abraham had a son, Isaac, that promise was passed down through, and then Isaac had a son, Jacob. When Jacob was a young man, his parents wanted to get him out of town. There were a couple of reasons for that. One, they didn't want him marrying any of the local girls. And two, Jacob's brother wanted to kill him. So the parents say, hey, We have a good idea. Let's send Jacob to stay with his mother's family. Jacob can stay out of harm's way, and maybe he can find a wife there among his mother's people. So Jacob goes to his mother's family, and there he meets Rachel. He is emotionally overcome, first because he has found people who are part of his own family, and second, because Rachel is very beautiful. Jacob says he will work for 7 years if, at the end of that time, he can marry Rachel. Unfortunately, Rachel's father tricks Jacob and first marries him off to his other daughter, Leah. Jacob is not happy about this, but he works for 7 more years until he can finally marry Rachel. So here now we have Jacob married to both Rachel and her sister, Leah. Now, Rachel, unfortunately, is unable to have children, but Leah, her sister, has a number of children. So Rachel is upset and says to Jacob, "I want to have my own children." She says, "Give me children or else I will die." Well, since Rachel seems to be barren, she decides to send Jacob in to her maidservant, and so Rachel's maidservant has some children for Jacob. Then Leah decides, "Well, I want to have some more children," so she sends Jacob in to her maidservant. So here we have poor Rachel. She is the love of Jacob's life, but her sister has borne Jacob a number of sons. Her maid has borne Jacob a number of sons. Her sister's maid has borne Jacob a number of sons, but she has no children at all. Finally, God has pity on Rachel and opens her womb, and she gives birth to a son, Joseph. And then, lastly, Rachel becomes pregnant again. It says that she is traveling with Jacob. They are traveling from Bethel to Bethlehem, and somewhere on the journey from Bethel to Bethlehem, Rachel gives birth to her second son, Benjamin, but ironically and tragically, she dies in childbirth. She said she would die without children, and here she dies giving birth to her second son, Benjamin. And so Rachel is buried somewhere on the road between Bethel and Bethlehem. Now, at this point, I want to talk about geography for a minute. I'm going to use very rough numbers for the distances involved, but let's start with the village of Bethlehem. Roughly 5 miles north of Bethlehem is Jerusalem. Roughly 5 miles north again of Jerusalem is a place called Ramah. And roughly 5 miles north of Ramah is the town of Bethel. So, starting from Bethel, going in 5 mile increments, Bethel, south to Ramah, south to Jerusalem, south to Bethlehem. So 15 miles between Bethel and Bethlehem, roughly. 10 miles, roughly, between Ramah and Bethlehem. Today, 1 mile north of Bethlehem is a site called Rachel's Tomb. It's been there for a long time. That may indeed be the burial place of Rachel. It is. So of the 15-mile journey from Bethel to Bethlehem, they would have gotten 14 miles before Rachel gave birth to Benjamin and died, so about a mile before Bethlehem. However, scholars debate about whether this is actually the tomb of Rachel. What most agree on is this: Rachel's tomb might be that place a mile north of Bethlehem. At any rate, it is probably somewhere in the roughly 10 miles between Ramah and Bethlehem. It may be closer to Ramah, it may be closer to Bethlehem, it's a little bit hard to say. Now, this is a very touching story. Rachel desperately wanted to have children. She had one son, Joseph, and then she died giving birth to her second son, Benjamin. So, this is the background then to what we read in Jeremiah, which is the part that Matthew is referring back to. Jeremiah 31:15. Thus says Yahweh, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Okay, so what is Jeremiah talking about then? What do we know about this? Well, let me tell you some things we know. First of all, we know that Rachel has been dead for a very long time. This is metaphorical language that Jeremiah is using. It is as if Rachel were weeping. If Rachel knew what was going on, Rachel would be weeping. Next, we know that Ramah seems to be the place where the Babylonians assembled the conquered Jews before deporting them to Babylon. Remember that the Babylonians are conquering the southern kingdom at this point, so they're bringing people up to Ramah to sort of stage them and take care of things before they're deported to Babylon. Jeremiah lived through these years, the years before the Babylonian conquest and during the Babylonian conquest. Remember Israel's history. God had established the 12 tribes of Israel in the Promised Land. They would be greatly blessed if they were faithful in following God. God had established the throne of David and made great promises concerning that. Great blessing would come through the throne of David to Israel and the entire world. But again, it required the kings descended from David to be faithful. Israel was not faithful. First of all, the northern tribes split off to form their own kingdom. And a century before Jeremiah's time, as we have seen in some of the other passages we've been looking at, the Assyrians had conquered the northern kingdom and carried them into exile. Now, the Babylonians were doing the same to the southern kingdom. The people had been faithless. Many of the kings descended from David had been faithless. Not all of them. Some of them were good, but many of them were not. Now, God's judgment was coming upon them. And in the city of Ramah, the Babylonian conquerors were gathering their captives together before they deported them to Babylon. Okay, so what else do we know? We know that Rachel has a special connection to the Jewish people. As the love of Jacob's life, we could think of her symbolically as the mother of all Israel. But obviously, she has an even closer connection to the tribes that came from her two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And as it happens, one of her sons had descendants who joined the northern kingdom, and one of her sons had descendants who joined the southern kingdom. Rachel's son Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and Ephraim and Manasseh became two great tribes of the 10 tribes that formed the northern kingdom. In fact, when the prophets wanted to refer to the entire northern kingdom, they often used the name Ephraim. Ephraim was a direct descendant of Rachel. Rachel had Joseph, Joseph had Ephraim. And his name was given to the entire northern kingdom at times. So Joseph and his descendants very much associated with the ultimate northern kingdom, which the Assyrians had conquered. However, the tribe from Rachel's other son, Benjamin, did not join the northern kingdom. Benjamin and Judah were the two tribes that formed the southern kingdom. And of course, Judah is the tribe that David belongs to. The southern kingdom retained the throne of David, centered in its capital at Jerusalem. And that's the people that Benjamin and the tribe of Benjamin joined together with. So Rachel had direct descendants in both the southern and the northern kingdoms. And then finally, as we've been mentioning here, geographically, we know that Rachel's tomb is not far from Ramah. Her tomb is somewhere between Ramah and Bethlehem, which is about a 10-mile stretch. So somewhere in there is her tomb. So here, I think, is the picture that Jeremiah is painting in this verse. As the captives are gathered for deportation in Ramah, they hear, off in the distance, the wailing of Rachel. Rachel in her tomb is weeping for her children. And Rachel has a lot to weep about. The children of her son Joseph had been sent into exile by the Assyrians a century before, and now the children of her son Benjamin were being sent into exile in Babylon. In fact, the town of Ramah is in the territory of the tribe of Benjamin. So Jeremiah has painted a vivid metaphorical picture involving geography, history, and theology. Geographically, Rachel's tomb is just down the road. The deportation to Babylon is happening right next door. Historically, what we know about Rachel tells us that all of Rachel's hopes for her children have been dashed. Of course, what she wanted in having children was for them to have descendants and for them to have descendants and ultimately for them to enter into the blessing and promise that God had promised to the descendants of Abraham and specifically to the descendants of Jacob. She wanted nothing more than to have children that would live and be blessed. But now both the northern and the southern kingdom have been destroyed. Her children are no more. Theologically, this is not just about the downfall of a nation. Israel is the nation of promise. God promised them blessing. God promised that they would bless the world. And yet, now judgment has come upon the entire peoples, northern and southern kingdom alike. Israel has failed to find blessing. It has failed to be the blessing that God said it would be. And so Rachel is in her tomb weeping. Okay, so this is a pretty heavy verse. You might imagine that it is found in a context filled with heavy verses, with language of judgment and loss. If you know anything about the book of Jeremiah, there's a lot of heavy language in the book of Jeremiah about judgment and loss. So you would think this must be a pretty particularly gloomy section of Jeremiah. But actually, this verse about Rachel weeping is found in the sunniest and most hopeful part of Jeremiah. In fact, in chapter 31, this is almost the only downer of a verse in the whole chapter. The rest of it is very hopeful. Chapters 30 through 33 of Jeremiah are filled with the promises of God for the ultimate restoration of Israel. This bad thing that is happening is not the end of the story. God has something that he's still going to do. Israel needs physical restoration, and it needs spiritual restoration, and that is what God is promising to do. In fact, in this very context is one of the most well-known passages concerning God's promise of spiritual restoration of Israel. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to read some selected passages starting in Jeremiah 30 and go through chapter 33. I'm just going to pick these little chunks. So I'll tell you what they are, but I don't know if you want to try to follow along with me. But I want to give you a feel for the sort of thing that Jeremiah is talking about in this context that this verse about Rachel weeping comes from. So, like I say, you can try to follow along, or probably you'd be better off not even trying. But chapter 30, verse 3. For behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel and Judah. That's the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The Lord says, I will also bring them back to the land that I gave to their forefathers, and they shall possess it. Chapter 30, verse 8. It shall come about on that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that I will break his yoke off their neck and will tear off their bonds, and strangers will no longer make them their slaves, but they shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up for them. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, declares the Lord, and do not be dismayed, O Israel, for behold, I will save you from afar and your offspring from the land of their captivity, and Jacob will return and will be quiet and at ease, and no one will make him afraid. Chapter 31, verse 1. At that time, declares the Lord, I will be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. Chapter 31, verse 11. For the Lord has ransomed Jacob and redeemed him from the hand of him who was stronger than he. They will come and shout for joy on the height of Zion, and they will be radiant over the bounty of the Lord, over the grain and the new wine and the oil, and over the young of the flock and the herd. And their life will be like a watered garden, and they will never languish again. Then the virgin will rejoice in the dance, and the young men and the old together. For I will turn their mourning into joy, and will comfort them and give them joy for their sorrow. I will fill the soul of the priests with abundance, and my people will be satisfied with my goodness, declares the Lord. Thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Thus says the Lord, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work will be rewarded, declares the Lord, and they will return from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, declares the Lord, and your children will return to their own territory. Here is the very familiar chapter 31, verse 31. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. They will not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more. Chapter 32, verse 36. Now therefore, thus says the Lord God of Israel concerning this city of which you say, it is given into the hand of the king of Babylon by sword, by famine, and by pestilence. Behold, I will gather them out of all the lands to which I have driven them in my anger, in my wrath, and in great indignation, and I will bring them back to this place and make them dwell in safety. They shall be my people, and I will be their God, and I will give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me always for their own good and for the good of their children after them. I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them to do them good, and I will put the fear of me in their hearts so that they will not turn away from me. I will rejoice over them to do good and will faithfully plant them in this land with all my heart and with all my soul. Finally, chapter 33, verse 14. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the good word which I have spoken concerning the house of Israel and the house of Judah. In those days and at that time, I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness on the earth. In those days, Judah will be saved, and Jerusalem will dwell in safety, and this is the name by which she will be called, the Lord is our righteousness. Okay, so, sorry, there's a chunk of reading there. But we see some important things from this context. I mean, I hope you noticed that thing about Rachel weeping, that's the only downer in all of that stuff. First, we see that God gives this oracle about Rachel so that he can immediately comfort her. In chapter 30, verse 15, again, thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Thus says the Lord, restrain your voice from weeping. He's comforting Rachel, and your eyes from tears, for your work will be rewarded, and they will return from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, declares the Lord, and your children will return to their own territory. So yes, Rachel is weeping now, And this is something that Jeremiah is taking very seriously because he's living through these events. He is watching the downfall of the throne of David. He is watching the deportation to Babylon. He himself has taken to Ramah and yet manages to not be deported to Babylon. This is a sad and difficult time for Jeremiah. But as God is saying in this oracle, yes, Rachel is weeping. Many of her children are gone and more of them are going, but God offers her comfort. Rachel's work in bringing forth children will be rewarded. They will return. There is hope for their future and thus for her future. And what is the nature of this hope as we see it in these chapters? Basically three things. Both the southern and the northern kingdom will be regathered in the land. They will undergo a spiritual restoration. And once again, the throne of David will be established. Those last two are particularly important. Why did all these troubles come upon Israel in the first place? Because the hearts of Israel had been hard. They rebelled against God. They broke the covenant he had made with them. And so God says, well, okay, I'm going to make a new covenant with you. This time, you're not going to break that covenant because I am going to write my law in your heart. I'm going to change your heart. He says, I will give them one heart and one way that they may fear me always for their own good. They need to fear God. They need to submit to God. And so he's going to give them hearts that will do that. Never again will they suffer for their rebellious ways because they will no longer have rebellious ways. They are not going to be those kinds of people anymore because they are never going to live at peace until their hearts are changed, and so God promises to change their hearts. Furthermore, the restoration of the throne of David is also very important. God had promised that great blessing would come to Israel and to the world through the throne of David, and yet the throne has been destroyed. Many of the Davidic kings were evil, and God has brought judgment, and that throne is gone. God, however, is still going to keep his promise. They are going to once again be ruled by David, by someone sitting on the throne of David, ruling over Israel and all the world in peace. So God tells them that he will raise up David, their king. He says, I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness on the earth. And this righteous king in the line of David, of course, is the one that we call the Messiah. This is a passage that ultimately is talking about Jesus. So here's the picture that we get from Jeremiah 31, verse 15. Rachel, the one who longed to have children, the one who died in childbirth near Ramah and Bethlehem, lies in her grave. Near her, the captives are being gathered at Ramah. At Ramah, therefore, Rachel can be heard in the distance weeping for her children from the southern kingdom, who are being conquered and deported to Babylon, as well, I think, as for her children from the northern kingdom, who had been conquered by the Assyrians a century before. It seems like the end of all her hopes, and yet God tells her that she should be comforted. Israel will once again gather in the land. God will spiritually restore their hearts so that they may live, and they will once again have the throne of David ruling over them and all the earth in justice and righteousness. Okay, so now we turn back to Matthew. Let me read once again, chapter 2, what was it, verse 16. Then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged, and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its vicinity, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the Magi. Then what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. Well, It's pretty clear, I hope, from what we talked about, that Jeremiah is not predicting that children would be killed in the city of Bethlehem. That is not what Rachel is weeping over in Jeremiah. She is weeping because the Assyrian and Babylonian conquests have devastated the hopes and future of her children. So, why does Matthew say that the killing of the children in Bethlehem fulfills the Jeremiah passage? At this point, I want to remind you of several beliefs that I have. I discussed these in our last session, but I need to trot them out again. First, I trust Matthew. Matthew can see just as clearly as we can that Jeremiah is talking about the Assyrian and Babylonian conquests. It doesn't take long, actually, to look at it and see that that's the case. Matthew is not stupid. He's not trying to deceive us. I don't think he's making a bad point in referring to this passage. He's doing something that is intelligent and worthwhile with the passage from Jeremiah. Secondly, I believe that Matthew expects us to know our Old Testaments well. In this case, Matthew expects us to consider the overall message and context of this passage from Jeremiah. Third, I believe we need to discover what Matthew means by fulfilled by observing how he uses it, because he means different things at different times. In this case, he obviously does not mean that Jeremiah was predicting Herod's massacre of the children. The event fulfilled the Jeremiah passage in some other way, which we need to try to understand. Fourth, I believe that there is a strong theological connection between Israel and Jesus. Jesus, the Messiah, is the one who fulfills the promises made concerning Israel. Through him, Israel will bless the world. Through him, Israel will find its own promise of blessing. And I think that's relevant to the passage we're looking at today. There was a fifth point I made last week, but I'm going to wait and say something about that at the end. Okay, so, but those points, I still believe, and I think they need to inform how we approach what Matthew is doing with Jeremiah. So, what is Matthew doing? How is he connecting the Jeremiah passage with these events in Bethlehem? I just need to tell you that this is a difficult question, and students of Matthew debate this question very much. There are many proposals that people give for what's going on here. What I want to do is explain to you what makes the most sense to me about what Matthew is doing. I think Matthew starts out by noticing an interesting geographical point. The passage in Jeremiah depends on the fact that Rachel's tomb is just down the road from Ramah. And Ramah was this place where the hopes and future of Israel seemed to be threatened. Rachel's children were supposed to find blessing from God and supposed to bless the world and lead it into righteousness. And yet, the entire nation has been defeated by foreign powers as a judgment from God. They do not live in blessing and peace. Most of the people were sent into exile many years ago, and now the rest are being gathered in Ramah for deportation to Babylon. And so, in the metaphorical picture that Jeremiah paints, Rachel, in her tomb, not far from Ramah, is weeping for the loss of all her hopes for her children. Well, Rachel's tomb is also just down the road from Bethlehem, where Herod has massacred the Jewish children. Rachel was a mother weeping for her children in Ramah, just down the road from her tomb. And here also are some children for a mother to weep over just down the road from her tomb. Once again, we can imagine the sounds of weeping coming from Rachel's tomb just down the road. So I think this is Matthew's starting place. Rachel's tomb is geographically close to two places where tragic events in the history of Israel have occurred. Now, I don't think that Matthew is just making a casual analogy. He says that the Jeremiah passage is fulfilled in the massacre of the children. In other words, there is a significance to the Jeremiah passage that is deepened and brought to some sort of fullness in the events in Bethlehem. There is this fulfillment, this filling out of the significance of what Jeremiah was talking about. So here's the question then we face. What is this fulfillment? What is it about what's happening in Jeremiah that Matthew is saying we find a fulfillment in some sense, a filling out, a deepening of the significance of that thing here in this event in the life of Jesus? This is the hardest question, of course. So let me tell you how I think about this. To start with, I don't think we can say that the massacre of the children is a bigger tragedy than what Jeremiah was talking about. Bethlehem is a small village, and it is probably a small number of children who died. Not that it's, I mean, each death, of course, was important, but I feel certain that many more people died, many more children even probably died in the events of the Assyrian and Babylonian conquests of Israel. There was a lot more suffering and death that happened in the events that Rachel is weeping over in Jeremiah than what happened in this particular event. No, I think that what makes the events in Bethlehem a fuller expression of the Jeremiah passage is the fact that the Messiah is involved. Why did these children die? They died because Herod wanted to kill the Messiah. Each one of those children died because he might have been the Messiah. Herod didn't know. And so each child that was potentially the Messiah of Israel, Herod had killed. In the deepest sense, Israel is still in exile. The Jews may be back in the land, but the blessing that God promised has not come about yet. They have been conquered by Rome, which is the latest replacement for Babylon. It's all the same. Their king Herod is just a puppet of Rome. He's not Jewish himself. He doesn't have their interests in heart. In Jeremiah, Rachel is weeping because her hopes for her children seem to have come to an end. Foreign nations have conquered Israel. It seems that Israel's hope to live in peace and righteousness under their Davidic king has come to nothing. Well, in a very real sense, now Israel's hope is truly being threatened. The Messiah, the Son of David, is the person in whom Israel's true hope resides. Without the Messiah, they have no hope. The Messiah was the one Israelite in whom all the hopes of the world are gathered. I would bet that the mothers of Bethlehem had all prayed that the Messiah would come to deliver them. And now the Messiah has been born. And what happened? Herod, the puppet of the Roman conquerors, kills their children in an effort to kill Israel's Messiah, which of course would truly be to kill Israel's hope once and for all. Each one of those children died because the foreign conquerors of Israel wanted the Messiah dead. If the Babylonian exile seemed like the end of all Israel's hopes, the death of the Messiah would truly have been the end of all her hopes. And yet, just as in Jeremiah, God's promises still stand. Remember, in Jeremiah, Rachel's weeping is described only so God can go on to comfort her. Her children will return. Her children will be restored spiritually. Her children will be ruled in righteousness by the king descended from David. And I think Matthew wants us to remember that context as he quotes this passage. He wants us to think of the entire context that the verse is found in Jeremiah. Because remember, after all, Herod does not succeed in killing Jesus. He tried. A number of Jewish children died because he tried. But Jesus lived. And he is going to go on to fulfill the promises made in Jeremiah. Jesus goes on in his ministry to work for the spiritual restoration of his people. Jesus even speaks of himself as bringing about the new covenant, just as Jeremiah had talked about. Jesus goes on to reveal himself as the Messiah, the Son of David, who will rule over all the world, just as Jeremiah talked about. And Jesus goes on to conquer death so that even the dead children of Bethlehem can hope to find life through him. Okay, so as I mentioned the last time when we were talking about another passage, this sort of approach can seem incredibly complicated. Does Matthew really expect anyone to follow all this? Do I have a hope of even being close to being right in what I'm saying about what Matthew is doing? Well, remember, my conclusion, and it's not just based on these passages, it's throughout the whole book of Matthew, it seems clear to me that Matthew expects us to know the Old Testament well. What I have just said is very complicated, mostly because I'm trying to explain everything all at once. The history, the passage in Jeremiah, what's going on in Matthew. But to someone who understood Jeremiah well, I think the connection would be easier to see. In Jeremiah, Rachel, mother of Israel, weeps in her grave not far from where her children are being gathered for deportation by foreign conquerors. It seems that all her hopes for the nation descended from her children have failed, and yet God promises that the promises made to Israel will be fulfilled, that they will experience spiritual restoration and life under the rule of the Davidic king. In Bethlehem, it seems that the hopes of Israel are even more at risk. The Messiah, the Davidic king, has come, and the foreign conqueror is trying to kill the Messiah by killing Jewish children, hoping to kill the Messiah in the process. Now Rachel in her grave has something even bigger to weep over. Will the suffering of her children never stop? But Jesus has escaped, and as the Messiah, the true Davidic king, he will bring about the spiritual restoration and life that God has promised. Okay, I have a couple of concluding comments here. This first comment is a little technical. I hope that it makes sense and will be profitable. In our last session, I said as my fifth point of things that I believed about how to understand Matthew in this context, I said that I believe that at times God orchestrated the events of Israel's life and Jesus' life to bring out the connection between them. I do believe that, but that is not really how I am picturing what's happening in our passage today. In our last session, we talked about how Matthew quoted the passage, "Out of Egypt I called my son." In its original context, that verse was talking about Israel and the exodus from Egypt under Moses. I argued that God sent Jesus to Egypt and then brought him back to deliberately remind us of the exodus. Both Israel and Jesus found refuge in Egypt, and both of them were called by God out of Egypt back to the land of promise. I argued that God told Joseph to take Jesus to Egypt precisely so this connection would be highlighted. God was urging us to ask, in the way that he orchestrated events, why did God do that way? And God did that to highlight for us the way that Jesus was, in a sense, the true Israel, the one who fulfilled the promises God had made to Israel. In today's passage, however, if I had to vote, I don't think Matthew is saying God deliberately chose to have the children killed near Rachel's tomb in order to send a message. I think it makes more sense to see Matthew as the one who is drawing the analogy here. Matthew sees a similarity. In both cases, a tragedy happens to the children of Rachel, and this tragedy happens geographically near to her tomb. And so Matthew uses that geographical similarity to make his own theological point. In a way, Jewish children dying because they might be the Messiah could be an even bigger blow to Israel's hopes than the Babylonian exile. If we lose the Messiah, we lose everything. What could be worse than the world conspiring to destroy the Messiah? And yet, Jesus is actually the fulfillment of all the promises God made in Jeremiah. The theological connection between Israel and Jesus is one that has been established by God through his promises. The geographical connection around the tomb of Rachel is something that Matthew noticed and is using to draw attention to the theological point. I don't know if that makes sense to you. You can ask me questions about it afterwards if you would like. Now, I don't know if this is significant. This may be making way too much of this, but in the other three fulfillment passages, Matthew uses a particular form of the verb that means something like this. These things happened in order that it might be fulfilled. These things happened that it might be fulfilled. We're talking about the use of a subjunctive passive here in these cases, implying, I think, in those cases that there is purpose. Part of the purpose of the event in Jesus' life was to fulfill the Old Testament in some way. But in this passage, Matthew just says that what Jeremiah said was fulfilled. Not this happened in order that it might be fulfilled, what Jeremiah said, but just this did fulfill what Jeremiah had said. Perhaps providing support for my contention, and perhaps not, but perhaps a little bit of a hint that Matthew is not claiming that this event was intended somehow to be a fulfillment of Jeremiah's passage in Jeremiah 31. Matthew himself is the one who is just drawing the analogy to show that there is a kind of theological fulfillment happening between the two events. So maybe, maybe not. Let me just end by asking the question, why has Matthew done this? Why is he doing this stuff at all? What would we have lost if Matthew had just told the story of Herod massacring the children and had not tied it to the Jeremiah passage with this language of fulfillment? What would we have lost? Well, the way I would answer that question right now is what we would have lost is the way Matthew has highlighted for us the place that Jesus' story has in salvation history. God promised great things to the Jewish people. God promised great things to the world through the Jewish people. The Assyrian and Babylonian conquests were judgments from God on the Jewish people. But those judgments seem to have raised serious doubts about God's promises. Where are the promised blessings? Matthew is tying Jesus back into the larger story of the Jewish people, a story of promise and then seeming defeat. The massacre of the children seems like another setback in the story of God's promised blessing. The Messiah comes and he gets children killed. This is what we were looking for. In the end, though, Jesus surely will and does conquer evil and death, and the promised blessings will surely come. I was thinking about this as I was driving over. Without these fulfillment passages, the story that we see in the birth narratives in Matthew, they would be a little bit just like the origin stories in the superhero movies. How did Spider-Man get to be Spider-Man? Well, he got bit by a radioactive spider. So how did Jesus get to be the Messiah? Well, he was born of a virgin, and his dad had some messages from angels, and, you know, it was cool. But these fulfillment passages keep bringing us back to the fact that there is this big story that God is telling, and it is about the people of Israel and the promised Savior of the world coming through the Jewish people. And it's by highlighting these things with these fulfillment passages that we remember that this is part of something that God has planned and has been doing from the beginning. Okay, so I know, hard issues. We have some time for you to berate me or ask questions or whatever you'd like to do.
This feels like that scene in the movie The Nativity, when Herod tells the Magi, you know, go find him, and you can tell he's up to something, right? Mm-hmm. And then when things don't work out his way, he kills the children. He is deliberately killing the child that would be Messiah, mm-hmm. that would be in the line of David, that would right. replace him.
Yes.
It's a slam on those passages in Jeremiah where, and he will never lack for a man to sit on the throne. Mm-hmm. He knew that, probably, some of his education.
Yeah, I did comment that I'm not sure how much Herod believed about all of that stuff, it's hard to say, but surely, I mean, yes, I mean, he knew some things for sure.
He at least feared that a popular uprising supporting this guy could throw him off his throne.
Right.
And it's just as bad as Rachel seeing her boys, all the boys of Israel being hauled off in slavery. There goes our chance at a Messiah. They or their sons or their sons' sons would have been the guy that would have sat for David. I mean, it's so evil for him to do that, to just say, kill the Messiah.
Yeah.
So I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. He's really pre-narrating the events like the chorus does in Henry V. Or is it Henry V?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, setting them up.
Did me raising my hand cut you off from responding to Logan?
No, well, Logan was agreeing with me, so I didn't want to, if I said anything, I might have ended up messing the whole thing up. So if you want to just agree with me, I won't respond to what you say either.
I really liked, too, how your explanation highlights and points out that Matthew is highlighting the seriousness of Herod's action, because he's about to cut off all of Israel's hope, but like in Jeremiah, then God is saying, no, but it's really okay. And in this passage, it's really okay because God has provided for the Messiah to be rescued. So I was just going to say that like that. But I have some questions about this word fulfill, because here it seems like we have what Jeremiah is talking about, which has to do with the Babylonian invasion, which was fulfilled, I would think, in a certain sense, because they all get carried away, and that is threatened. A future fulfillment that hasn't yet come, seems like, where everybody is going to, well, you're talking about the new covenant and them being actually reigned over by the Messiah, seems like that's off in the future. And then these things that Matthew's saying are fulfillments, they're kind of happening in this middle time, seems like. So is to fulfill something like you have a bottle of water and each time something significant happens, kind of pour more water into this bottle till it's all the way filled up, but each of these events is kind of filling it out a little bit more? Or so I'm just wondering how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, I recognize that I haven't done the greatest job in explaining how this what the word fulfill means. I find it difficult to pin down exactly the flavor of this word. I do think that Matthew's focus here is on this particular verse with Rachel weeping. So we could say that the emphasis, it would be something like this. The situation is, when we understand it, the situation is even more dire down the road in Bethlehem here than it was down the road at Ramah. But we can remember that ultimately Rachel can be comforted because God will keep these promises. So the fulfillment that we're talking about here is, this is even more a thing for Rachel to be weeping over than was that other thing because of the seriousness of what has happened there. I've always liked, Jack is the one who first talked about this stuff in a way that made sense to me. This was many, many years ago, 40 years ago, I think, something like that. But I remember Jack pointing out that this word, plerao, fulfilled, is used by James in the book of James. So James is talking about the event where Abraham offers up Isaac. And he says that that event fulfilled the passage that said Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. So we have to remember the scenario here. Before Isaac was born, God promised Abraham that he would have descendants, you know, like the sands of the sea and so forth. And Abraham believed the promise that was made to him, and God reckoned it to him as righteousness. That is, Abraham was right with God because he was the sort of person who took God at his word and believed what God had promised him concerning having descendants. So That statement is not in any way a prediction. It's just a statement about how Abraham was justified by his faith. But James is saying that later on, the event where Abraham, after Isaac has been born, and God asks him to offer up Isaac, and Abraham is willing to do that, he says that fulfills the earlier passage. Well, it wasn't a prediction. It's not that it predicted that Abraham was going to be willing to sacrifice Isaac, and then he did. But what it was a statement about the sort of person that Abraham was, that he believed what God had told him, and God accepted him on that basis. What was fulfilled, we can see, is that Abraham moved from a description that says he believed this, God told him this and he believed it. What we see is Abraham acting on that belief. This is the way I would explain the connection between them. So that when Abraham offered up Isaac, it was a filling up in some way of what had been earlier. Here, it's describing an invisible, internal sort of attitude that Abraham has that God is recognizing. Now we are seeing that attitude showing itself in the world and gaining weight and substance through action, something like that. So when I say that what we're trying to do with Matthew is to see in each case what exactly, what kind of a thing he has in mind by fulfilled, that's what I'm saying is that it may not be that he sees any sort of a prediction in what was happening before, but he sees something, and what we've been looking at is things about the promises made to Israel or concerning Israel or the events in Israel's life that find their ultimate expression in the life of their Messiah, the one who is going to fulfill the promises that were made to them beforehand. So it's not a fulfillment in the sense of it's a prediction, but it is a filling up. It is bringing to its fullness something that was implicit in this earlier thing. So in this case, I'm saying that what Matthew is seeing is God has brought upon Israel a judgment that seems to have brought to an end the promises of blessing and ultimate restoration of the world even that were made concerning Israel. The Assyrian and Babylonian captivities have thrown down everything that seems like God could have done with them. And at the beginning of Jesus' life, we see that Israel is still in the same sad situation under the thumb of the Romans, but now so bad as to even their ruler is actually killing them in the hopes of killing their ultimate hope, the Messiah himself. So this is the fuller and deeper expression of the seemingly hopeless sort of situation that would cause Rachel to weep. Because look at what's happening here. And yet, what Rachel needs to be comforted, because this is in fact not the end of the story. This is going to be rescued and redeemed. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's the sort of thing that I'm seeing and trying to get at. It's a subtle sort of thing. When we hear the word fulfilled, it's easy for us to think of it in terms of prediction and predicted event. And Matthew does use the word fulfilled that way sometimes, I think. But in these passages so far, that's not the way he's been using them. Possible exception of the virgin passage from Isaiah, if you interpreted that a certain way. But since at this point I'm not prepared to interpret it in that way, I think all three of the ones we've seen so far are more like there's something implicit in this about Israel and its the promises that God has made to them that now is finding its deeper and fuller expression in the events of the life of Jesus in some way.
That makes sense. The only one that seems like it would be a prediction, like you're saying, would be what the scribes tell Herod when they ask when he asks them where the Messiah is going to be. But all the rest of them, I think you're right, are, it's more of a dynamic that we see in the prophecy.
Right.
And then that dynamic is repeated, not in a way that you can draw a neat, tidy analogy to every single aspect of the event, because we don't have a repetition of the Jews going into exile here, right, like you pointed out. But there is, their hope is being jeopardized. And that's a sort of dynamic, like in the Abraham passage that you brought up. So I like that. That helps me think about it. It's not that we have a repetition of events so much as a repetition of a dynamic, yeah. That finds deeper expression.
Right. You'll notice I've been talking about the four Old Testament passages in the birth narratives. You're right. There's a fifth Old Testament passage in the birth narratives, and that's the one where Herod goes to the scribes and says, "Where's the Messiah going to be born?" And they point to Micah and say, "In Bethlehem," and they quote the thing from Micah. That's in the story itself. That's not, as I would read it, that's not Matthew putting a commentary in. He's just telling the story. How did they decide he was going to be born in Bethlehem? They looked at the prophetic prediction that said he was going to be born in Bethlehem. And I think Matthew would see that as a prophetic prediction. I would see it as a prophetic prediction. But the ones that Matthew puts in, the other four in those stories, each time when he says this was fulfilled, he seems to have something else in mind. Now, we've got one more to talk about. That's next time. This is the one I've told you before. The funny thing about this one is it's the quotation of an Old Testament passage that does not exist. So that one will be particularly interesting to sort out. But he uses the word fulfilled in that one. And of all the passages, that's, even though it's quoting a passage that doesn't exist, I think you might be able to argue that the word fulfilled in that one is closest to actually meaning it was predicted and this is how it turned out. So how's that going to work? I'm trying to leave you with, I got to come next week and find out how that works. So, okay.
Hey, Ron, if I was a medieval scholastic, I would summarize what you've said, and I would interpret the Bible by Aristotle, and I would say that Jesus is the telos of all these story themes. Mm-hmm. Is that the way that you would see it?
Yeah, not just by definition or arbitrarily, but when we understand the place that the Messiah has in the story that God is telling in the Old Testament, as it turns out, yes, he is the telos, he is the goal of all of this stuff. Yes.
Cool. So fulfillment, when I was thinking about how I would define telos and everything, I always kept coming back to the word fulfill. I'm like, well, that's probably a pretty good translation there.
Yeah.
And then I was wondering, it seems to me that Jesus' life was similar to the Jewish history. I wondered if that legitimized him in the eyes of the Jewish people as their Messiah.
Yeah, that's a really excellent question, and I've thought about that. So here's how my thinking has evolved on that question. Okay, let me see if I can describe the scenario here. It looks like, the thing that we modern rationalist people fear when we read the stuff in Matthew is that Matthew is just playing fast and loose. These passages aren't saying that, and he's making them say that, and he's twisting them and making them be about Jesus when they weren't about Jesus, and this is terrible. And so I have a natural reaction to that, to think that sort of thing wouldn't be persuasive to the Jews who took the Old Testament seriously, because they're not going to buy it, that those are predictions about Jesus. So then the next round is some scholars come along and say, but let's look at the way the rabbis did exegesis back then. And we look at, especially at the Talmudic literature and the Midrash and things like that, and they say, basically they say, look, they played fast and loose with the Old Testament. So Matthew's just playing fast and loose with the Old Testament the way they were playing fast and loose with the Old Testament. So how could they complain? Are they going to say, that's not saying that? Matthew's going to say, well, it's not saying what you were saying over there either, so I get to play too. There are different ways of putting that together. Okay, that was never satisfying to me. Now I have two other pieces to bring to this picture. Number one, we have one of the rabbis who came to visit us recently talking about the way the Jewish scholars in the early centuries did what he called Midrash. And I think he made an interesting case that they were not playing fast and loose, that actually we need to be paying attention to what they're doing in sort of the way that I'm saying we ought to be paying attention to what Matthew's doing. That they have, it's an intriguing and different way of presenting things, but actually there's nothing illegitimate about the way they're using the Old Testament. And I could be persuaded that that's the case. I don't know enough to know, but I thought that was interesting. And then finally, as I'm looking at these passages in Matthew, and I don't know, I can't tell. I hope that this process has been of some benefit to you all who have hung there with me as I've been trying to explain these things. I know I've been talking about this for quite a while, but this actually has been a very big deal to me here recently to be studying these things in Matthew. I find myself thinking about them in ways that I had not thought about them before. The connection to the Old Testament, the importance of the story of the Jews and their promises and the exile and all of that stuff is taking on a place in my thinking that is bigger than it was before. And I think I'm right in seeing that in what Matthew's doing. So coming back to your question then, it seems to me that yes, I think in a way you could say that Matthew could argue that there is a kind of an apologetic value in what he's doing as well, in that he would be saying, look at what God has done in the life of Jesus, which is not what you guys were expecting from the Messiah, but look at this story. Look at the themes that God has been developing in his work with Israel. Now that I present it this way, doesn't it make sense to you that that would be the Messiah? And so someone who is sympathetic and who will follow Matthew through what he's doing would look at that and go, yeah, okay, actually it does. So in that sense, yeah, I think it has the power to actually be persuasive. But you have to go a long way to do that. You can't, it's not the sort of thing that you're going to be casually saying, oh, I don't buy this Messiah stuff, and then you read Jeremiah and go, oh, now I'm convinced. That's not the way it would work. But yeah, right now, I think that's true. I would argue that that has some value, yeah.
And then the last thing is a lot more tenuous. I see that you could argue that Jesus suffered like Israel, and it's fitting that he be the Messiah because he knows how Israel has suffered. So like he's been through the history, and he spent 40 days in the wilderness and that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. I would have to qualify that a little bit, I think, and I'd have to think about how I would want to qualify it. But yeah, I mean, we know that Hebrews argues that he certainly is well aware of human suffering, but I think he is very aware of himself, not just as a human being saving human beings, but as a Jew who is fulfilling the promises of God to a people who have lost their way, and in that sense sees himself as being what they were not, including being faithful in the midst of the same sorts of sufferings that they faced in some ways. So yeah, I would buy that.
And even like how I think that Israel has been rejected as a people amongst the people, mm-hmm. And how he was rejected by his own people and everything.
Yes.
It just seems, I don't know if I'm just making that narrative up, but it looks pretty legitimate to me.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. That sounds right to me too. Maybe I should think more about it, but it does sound right to me right now, yeah.
I really appreciate the work you've done. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Okay, so I said that I was going to talk about three of the fulfillment passages, and I came and I only talked about one. And then I said I was going to talk about two of the fulfillment passages, and I came and I only talked about one. Next week, there's only one left. And I think I can pretty safely promise you that I'm going to talk about that passage next week, and we will be done with the birth narratives and move on to the next thing after that. But maybe you shouldn't believe my promises because I've lied twice. So I didn't mean to, but I did. Okay, thanks.